Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. The band is diverse, and if the word popular can be applied to a jazz group, then it fits here. Diverse, with trumpeter Herman Mahari, is out with a new disc recorded in Paris, and we'll hear it and talk about it in our second half today. Also up today, Brian McTavish swings by with your weekend to-do list. But first up, the FDA is out with a draft of new guidelines on off-label uses of drugs already on the market. That means alternate uses of a drug that go beyond the drug's original purpose. It's legal, but is it risky? With us today to talk about it is Rick Coldry. He's a director of pharmacy at the University of Kansas Hospital. And Rick, so good to have you here. Welcome.
It's so nice to be here, Steve. Thank you.
Well, how common is this? I mean, this using drugs for other purposes than what they're marketed for? Because if I understand right, it's pretty darn common.
No, you're absolutely right. It's actually a very, very common practice. And it's part of the natural evolution in treating patients with medications is that when they're initially studied and they're released and labeled by the FDA based on those initial evaluations and studies, the normal practice of medicine is to say, hey, if this patient has a similar type of disease state and it's treated by one medication, but it's not exactly what was labeled for, might it help this other patient? And so that's just part of the natural evolution of the practice of medicine. So off-label use is extremely common.
So how does a doctor know, though, you know, if there's, you know, if one use of a drug, we know that's okay, it's been labeled that way. How big of a risk is a doctor taking by using it for something similar but still sort of different?
Well, the risk varies. The variability of the risk depends on how much information is really out there. So let's talk for one second about how does this happen. So let's say, for example, that there's a medication on the market and has a labeled use, and there's a thought because of how the drug works in the patient that it might treat a different condition. So initially what might happen is that one patient and one physician somewhere might together decide, hey, there's this therapy. We don't know if it works, but it might work. Do you want to try it? And the patient says, okay, I understand the risk. Let's try it.
So the patient understands what's going on here.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then that those are typically in medical literature published as case studies, one or two, three patients as case studies. And then someone will pick that up and say, hey, we should really investigate this further and do a more formal scientific trial analysis. And that maybe publish that data. And then as it's successful, those studies and trials get bigger and bigger. So there's more data. And then eventually there's enough data that people are using the drug across the nation or across the world for a purpose that it wasn't originally labeled for, but treating patients very safely and very effectively. And that's just kind of part of the evolution of drug therapy treatment.
So is there any risk attached to this?
There's always risk.
Yeah. Welcome to life, right?
Right. There's always risk in healthcare with really anything that you're going to do. But what is, I think, probably – maybe difficult to understand unless you are in the medical profession or a pharmacist or physician or nurse, is that the drugs are chemicals, essentially.
Yeah.
And they're extensively studied, like what effects and how do they work.
I always thought they were like magic pills. They had nothing to do with chemistry. You take the little pill and suddenly whatever you have goes away. You know, you're saying it's chemistry. Now you're messing up my illusion here.
Sorry, I don't mean to dispel that for you. No, it's really very, very scientific. And there's a lot of physiology and biology and biochemistry that goes into that. And so you can have a pretty good notion about how it's going to act or how it might work for a different condition than it was labeled for.
Well, why don't drug manufacturers, Rick, when they, you know, come out with a new drug and they've tested it and they've gone through all this rigmarole that's, I know, very expensive, mm-hmm. and they know that it works for, you know, condition A, why, it seems to me, they would also want to find out at that time if it also works for B, C, and T, because that would expand the potential sales of that drug. Why doesn't that happen more often? Or maybe it does.
It does happen fairly often, really. But the drug company can't really predict what the medical community might determine are all the potential uses for a particular drug. So they certainly can't bear the costs of doing a large enough and widely approved enough trial on every potential indication to get that labeling inserted into their package by the FDA. That'd be really cost burdensome for them to do that.
You know, give us an example so everyone can sort of hang with our conversation here of what's a good example of what we're talking about here, this off-label use of a drug, maybe one of the more common ones with a popular drug that people might recognize.
Well, I can give you a couple to discuss.
To chew on here.
Yeah, to chew on. I don't know if they're going to be widely recognized medications. The one that I looked up to discuss on the show today that is a really good story is a drug that's called gabapentin. The brand name was Neurontin. It's generically available now. But when it was approved by the FDA in December of 1993, the original label was approved for treatments of various kinds of seizures.
Okay.
As the drug was being used, the medical community detected, based upon an understanding of how the drug worked, that it was able to treat some really difficult to treat types of pain, specifically pain related to diabetes, neuropathy, and other postoperative and neuropathic pain. And that drug's use was almost entirely consumed in treating those very difficult pain conditions and very limited use for treatment of seizures.
So a completely different use than what it was marketed for then, pretty much.
Right. Exactly. And they even went so far as to, because of the discovery in the medical community that this worked, a drug company studied a similar type chemical and in 2012 released a very similar type of a drug, and now that one is labeled for the treatment of these kinds of pains.
Now, maybe this is a question you can't answer because you weren't the doctor who first began to prescribe it for this different use, but why would a doctor assume that a drug that was marketed for seizures would suddenly have some benefits for folks who are dealing with deep-seated pain issues?
And it's that chemistry and physiology and biochemistry that I was referring to. It's in this particular medication's case, it really has to do with how the medication works. And there's a certain type of neuron receptor that this drug blocks that inhibits certain kind of seizures, but it's also those same types of neurons are related to pain. And so intelligent physicians across the community said, hey, I wonder if we block that receptor in these patients with this severe kind of pain, will it have an effect? And it turns out it did.
Well, why didn't the drug manufacturer recognize that coming out of the gate? Who knows?
It was never studied.
There's a $10 million question for you, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I don't think that – and actually, and I'm a little bit out of my element here – but, you know, this medication and those types of pains were known, but there wasn't really a lot of information on how widely spread they were. And no one had any anticipation that this drug would be as effective as it was for that purpose.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's get our listeners involved here. I mean, should more be done to discover and promote alternative uses of prescription medications? Are you using an off-label drug, and how has it gone for you? That's our question today. You can tweet us your answer at KCUR Up to Date. Or you can give us a phone call, 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888. We're talking about off-label uses of drugs being used for purposes other than which they were originally marketed for. We're visiting with Rick Coldry, who's director of pharmacy at the University of Kansas Hospital. And again, our number, 816-235-2888. Did you have another example you brought with you, too?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And this one is, you know, the example I gave you is fairly uncommon. The example I'm going to give you now is actually pretty common. There are some medications that are injectable medications, and the purpose of them is to prevent blood clots, usually typically right after surgery, because when you have a surgery and then you're immobilized, then you have a greater risk of your body forming a blood clot.
Yeah.
And these drugs are called low molecular weight heparins.
Yeah.
So let's just say that they're helped to prevent blood clots after surgery. Some of them were developed with the specific indication for after hip surgery. Some of them were developed for the specific indication for after knee surgery. But, of course, their use in various situations, mm-hmm. and even beyond just those types of maybe hip and knee surgeries, even other surgeries are used to prevent. And not all of those specific indications may necessarily be on the label.
That's interesting. So you're saying that a drug manufacturer originally can pinpoint a drug and say, this drug is for dealing with blood clots after a hip replacement surgery. This drug is for dealing with blood clots after a knee replacement surgery. Does it get down? Is it refined that far?
Yes. And that is part of how our system of safety for our for everyone that's kind of governed and regulated by the FDA works. If the weight is on the drug manufacturer mm-hmm. to sort of prove to the FDA that a drug works for a specific purpose. So the more purposes the drug company studies, the more money it costs them to get that into their label. And so that's just part of the strategy and how things work.
What, I mean, even have any idea, what does it cost, you know, for a drug company to sort of come out with a new drug and run it by the FDA and go through all these trials? I know it's like millions, right?
It's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Hundreds of millions of dollars.
Tons of money.
Yeah.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Off-label drug use is our topic here. Let's go to Cindy from Overland Park. Cindy, you're on with Rick Coldry. He's director of pharmacy at the University of Kansas Hospital. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to let you all know that actually off-label use saved my life. I have a rare lung condition. And
a lung condition, you said, Judy?
Yes, rare lung condition. Mm-hmm. And any those of us with rare diseases, it's very difficult to create clinical trials for us.
Ah.
So some research was being done on the disease. They discovered a pathway that they thought was involved with our disease, and there was actually a drug out there currently that addressed this pathway for something else. So my physician, I'm actually married to a physician as well, but my physician was willing to take a risk with me to try this drug. And so we did. The drug worked and has since then been proved to be effective in this disease.
That's a great story. I'm wondering about when you first began to use it, Judy, how big of a risk did you feel that you were taking?
It was scary. The drug itself is an immunosuppressant drug. The dosage that we had was pretty low. It's a drug that's been used in transplants, so there was some information out there. But it had never been used by itself. So what we didn't know was if I started taking this drug, would it create, would it suppress my immune system to the point where it would create problems for me?
How long did it take you to figure out whether or not that was going to happen?
Comfortably, probably a couple years. We definitely saw changes and improvement within 6 months of me being on the drug in terms of my lung function. So we knew the drug was working within 6 months. And then it was a couple years before we kind of had this comfort level that said, really this is from an immunosuppressant issue, it's kind of benign for me.
Can doctors test how your immune system was responding to this drug? Is there a way to do that while you're on this drug, or were you just sort of flying blind here?
We're flying blind a little bit and really just kind of watching for, am I getting more colds? Am I getting sick more often? That was really what we were looking for. Now, we still take precautions with it now. If I have to have a surgery or anything like that, we consider the risk that might be associated with being on an immunosuppressant. But in terms of just overall life, it really is benign.
God, Judy, you are such a great first caller today. You know, as you look at this, Rick, are you surprised by any of this, or this sounds like you've heard this story before?
No, I think this is a very, very common story.
Yeah.
Very, very common.
Well, Judy, I'm so glad you called. That's just a great first call on this topic of off-label drug use here. I sure appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I'm thankful for it. Like I said, it saved my life.
I'm so glad it worked out for you. You bet. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Let's go to Kim here from Lansing, Kansas. Kim, you're on up today. Good morning, Kim.
Hey, good morning. I was just calling to say that, first of all, I fully support doctors investigating the use of medications for uses other than what they're originally designed for about 10 years ago. As an ulcerative colitis patient, my GI doc told me about a medication, Remicade, which is an infusion, that showed anecdotal evidence of being effective in ulcerative colitis patients. It was designed for Crohn's disease patients.
Sure.
So I figured, what the heck, I'll give it a shot. And it worked absolutely like a charm and changed. It's held my condition in remission for probably 10 years. So I'm all for it. I was really jazzed when he offered me the opportunity to give it a try.
Oh, that's great. Again, a great call, Kim. I sure appreciate you making it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. You know, Rick, this all strikes me. There's something so counterintuitive to me about all this, because my impression of the medical community is that it is so concerned, understandably so, about lawsuits and stepping outside of very, very well-defined lines of, you know, how doctors treat patients and what protocols are and what procedures are. And yet, here we are talking about, you know, using a drug prescribed for cause A for cause D. And it just strikes me as more freewheeling, a more freewheeling aspect of the medical community that I never would have associated with it before.
Sure. And that's not really the case. I think both the callers today were actually really great examples.
Terrific.
Because especially, you know, the first caller, she was well aware of the risks and the potential benefits of that medication. And really, that's what medicine is doing all the time. That's how medicine advances and grows, is that you have a patient and nothing that's available to the medical community is working for them, but you want to heal them. You want to take care of them. And so then you know how something works. You maybe knew of a case study, like the second caller, so there was some anecdotal evidence that it might work for that drug, Remicade might work for her disease state. And you have a conversation and you assess how much risk that patient wants to take. And the one great thing about off-label drug use is if the drug is being used in other patients, you have a really, really good idea of what the risk profile is for that drug. And so it's, you can help that patient assess whether or not they want to try it. And, you know, in both these cases, they did. And
yeah,
that was a great benefit for them.
I'm wondering about liability, you know, again, you know, for the doctor. I'm wondering about liability for the pharmacy that prescribes this to begin with. Again, in a world that seems so concerned about liability, what about that?
Well, there's two sides to that liability. So, you know, one is if you are liable if there's harm to the patient and they are unaware, unwilling to accept the risk, and you put them in harm's way. That's something that is, you know, foreign or against of anything or anyone in healthcare. There's the other side of the liability. I mean, take again our two callers' examples today. If they didn't have a physician who was willing to take that risk with them and their disease state progressed and they had a bad outcome,
yeah,
then isn't that physician responsible for not going as far
for not as going as far as he or she could have?
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I didn't think about it that way. Yeah,
absolutely.
Do patients who agree to take something of a risk with an off-label use of a drug, Rick, do they have to sign something saying, "Okay, here's where we're going, and I understand the risks, and I'm going there"?
It's usually a consent is covered during a normal agreement to treat. There is only in the, I would say, only most commonly in the highest risk medications, for example, in chemotherapy,
yeah,
where, you know, you're essentially giving someone what you know is going to be somewhat toxic to their system.
Yeah.
So in those cases, there's a pretty specific consent about what the outcomes might be with that medication. And then other than that, for some of the things that we've talked about today, some of the medication examples we use, there wouldn't be a specific, hey, this drug is off-label consent, because either the risk was known and you're saying, you know, we're going to give you this medication that blocks blood clots,
yeah,
and you might bleed or have bruises, and you've just signed that as part of your consent, like, well, I want my knee surgery, so I know that might happen.
I want to get to some more callers here in just a second. Maybe just a final point here, this notion of you being director of pharmacy at the University of Kansas Hospital. I'm just wondering, to what extent are you, I'm guessing, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, amazed by the quantity of new drugs coming in the door every week, every month? I mean, things are coming in, all kinds of new things coming out all the time, right?
Absolutely. And I guess really, having been in the profession for a really long time, it's really something that we're happier about than overwhelmed about, because we could, again, I'm just referring to the caller today who had ulcerative colitis, and the drug Remicade is not that long ago, and there was not a lot of good treatment option before that drug came to the market. And so we're just happy we can take care of people.
So even the difference today from 5 years ago, 10 years ago, in terms of the array of potential prescription drugs, just incredible change, I imagine?
It is a state of constant and continual change.
I bet.
Absolutely.
I bet. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Vicky from Parkville. Vicky, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about off-label use of drugs. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to contribute that sometimes the off-label drug is because of a known side effect from that drug. For example, with losartan, it's been used for years as a blood pressure medication, but was known to suppress the protein called TGF-beta. And in my case, I have Marfan syndrome, which means I have too much TGF-beta that interferes with building muscle and blood vessel strength, so I have aorta aneurysm.
Wow.
But in this case, they were able to find a drug that would help much quicker than making a new drug, because this losartan was already out on the market and approved for something else, and it's now being used in a national health test to verify that it is helpful in Marfan syndrome. So that's my story.
Yeah, okay.
I just want to kind of mention, we've had three great callers today, and all of them are talking about disease states that they have that are not that common.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one of the callers made the point that those less common disease states, they are not widely studied with drugs. And sort of if off-label use wasn't something that evolved through medicine, they might not have these treatment options.
Yeah. Vicky, thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Hemander from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks. And you're a doctor, right, Hemander?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I work at in Kansas City area. I work on both the sides in Missouri and Kansas. I'm a nephrologist. I'm a kidney doctor. And I just wanted to add into the experience I've had in this issue. And thanks for all the opinions and the expertise we've had on this show and many other shows in the past, too.
Yes, sir.
I'm a regular listener. My experience has been that we have used certain drugs in the field of kidney disease, which are off-label indications. And it came across from the same principle we've discussed today earlier, that the drug is known to work in a certain way. And when we extrapolate those effects, we think the drug should be able to work in certain other conditions too. So we have some very profound and very serious kidney problems called glomerulonephritis, in which the basic functioning units of the kidneys get inflamed from various reasons. And we had certain drugs, for example, rituximab is a very commonly used drug nowadays, but when the drug came out, it was actually promoted as a drug for lymphomas and as a chemotherapy drug.
Yeah.
And over the course of time, we realized that some of that, the use of the drug could be used for other conditions, and doctors use them across the world in Europe and in the U.S., and many studies came out for the use of that drug in conditions like Degner's polyangiitis. I'm just throwing out some technical terms, but there were two big studies in Europe and the U.S., and they showed promising benefits.
Oh, that's great. Hemander, I'm glad you called. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
One other thing I wanted to get to here before we scoot on in our second half here, this notion of, you know, off-label use of an adult drug that might be used on children, I guess that's when things can get kind of tricky, right?
Well, you know, this is actually a significant issue in healthcare, in that just imagine how difficult it would be for a drug company or anyone to go and do enough studies on how a drug affected children or women who are pregnant or women who are breastfeeding.
Exactly.
That's something that, you know, no one really wants to put their child or their unborn child in harm's way. And so if you don't know how a drug is going to work, you don't want to give it to them. So it's really a matter of that there's not enough information out there about that. And so that's why in kids and in those other conditions, there just isn't enough information. And so they're not commonly or widely studied.
But it still happens, though, right? Kids end up taking adult drugs, and they maybe have some serious condition, and they've got to take the risk, I gather.
Right. Pediatricians and physicians who work with that patient population, they know how the physiology of children. And honestly, there's noted differences, but kids largely – there's not such really concept as an adult drug versus a pediatric drug. It's a matter of we don't have information. We don't have data on how it works in kids, but we know how it works in adults. And you kind of can – it's the same thing that our physician caller just said, is you can extrapolate how that's going to happen in the most of the time.
Mm-hmm. So. Let's go to Jim from Kansas City, Missouri. Jim, you're on Up to Date with Rick Colder. Good morning.
Good morning.
Colder.
Good morning,
yeah.
Rick.
Yeah.
Just a real quick story. I went to the emergency room with severe pain and at about a 9 out of 10. They admitted me to the hospital and ended up giving me gabapentin, which took care of the pain. I didn't care whether or not it was used for anything else at the time because it took care of the pain. So. It was a great drug. They didn't give me pain medication, which I'm thankful for because that would have just masked it. So they ended up really treating what was causing it.
Okay. Jim, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. One more call this segment. Felix from Lee Summit. Felix, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, very quickly. I'm a life insurance agent. Three
yes,
times
sir.
Lately, I have submitted life insurance applications on people. And the most recent one is a good example. He was declined because they were not familiar with the off-label use of a particular drug he was taking called buprenorphine. Normally, it's used for people who are coming down off of opiate addiction. He was having it used off-label by his doctor for something totally different. They declined him originally, and we had to have the doctor call the medical department at the large life insurance company, send them scholarly articles showing that it is used off-label for this particular condition, and they ultimately reversed it. He also told me that whenever he's had to go to the hospital over the years, when he reveals that he takes this off-label medicine, they automatically assume that indeed he is a recovering drug addict because they're not even familiar with the second concomitant use.
So the insurance industry might be behind the curve when it comes to off-label uses of drugs.
Not only them, but doctors in emergency rooms at various hospitals are not even familiar. They only know the main use of the drug, and he's encountered problems with that over the years. They assume he's a drug seeker when he's had to go to the hospital for his gallbladder problem, et cetera. So not only, yes, the medical directors at the insurance companies, but doctors at hospitals, too.
Rick, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I think that, I understand. It's interesting to me actually to learn that that's an insurance company issue. I hadn't really heard of that aspect of healthcare running into off-label use. And, I understand the drug buprenorphine, and he's right on the money for how it's used and what healthcare providers would presume that a patient is taking it for. And some of those so small conditions that are not widely known, that's really where this falls in.
Well, that's great. Well, Rick, you've been great. Thanks for taking some time with us today.
Pleasure.
Good information going out to folks who need to hear about this. Rick Coldry, he's a director of pharmacy at the University of Kansas Hospital. Thanks again, man. Appreciate
it. Thank you.